From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Is Eastern Ukraine in for a bloodbath? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Pro-Russian militants driven out of one eastern Ukrainian city have bombed three bridges leading into another where they plan a counteroffensive. They're demanding help against the Ukrainian army from Russia's President Putin, but the world is asking, why hasn't he answered? Whatever he does, a city of 1 million people may be in for protracted urban warfare. We'll hear what's at stake for Putin, Ukraine's new president, and assorted interests on both sides. Can the West help to avert a humanitarian crisis? Today's talking point, why does the U.S. import its own fish? First, here's the news.
Did you know that recycling your used car is a great way to become a KCRW member? You can donate your car, boat, motorcycle, or other vehicle in support of KCRW. It's one of the best ways to recycle. You'll not only benefit yourself with a KCRW membership and a nice tax deduction, but your car will help support all that you hear on KCRW, from music to news to your favorite cultural programs. We'll arrange everything from the pickup to the paperwork. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. A revitalized Ukrainian army is on the march against pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukrainian cities. Russian President Putin has not responded to calls for help from rebels he was encouraging just a few weeks ago. Why not? Is protracted urban warfare inevitable? Is there any prospect for peace? Today's talking point, 91% of the seafood eaten in the U.S. is imported, including a lot of what was originally caught in American waters. What does the Great American Fish Swap mean for health and well-being? First, this news update, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has ordered his forces to take the gloves off as he launches a major offensive against Hamas in the Gaza Strip. There have been airstrikes against 150 targets, and infantry troops have been mobilized for possible ground incursion. William Booth is Jerusalem bureau chief for The Washington Post. He joins us from Gaza City. Bill Booth, good to have you with us.
Nice to be with you, Warren.
What has provoked this?
Consistent, repeated, escalated rocket fire from Hamas and related militant factions in Gaza toward Israel. A day or so ago, there was about 100 salvos that came from the Gaza Strip towards Israel, many of them landing in Israel, causing some damage, no deaths, a lot of them landing in empty fields, but still it was a heightened and vigorous group of salvos from Hamas and related militant factions here in Gaza that got the Israelis up in arms.
Not just Hamas, then, others as well. Is this a response? You say the Israelis are up in arms. Is this a response to popular sentiment in Israel? Do they want the prime minister to take this kind of offensive?
These are usually popular in Israel, particularly when rockets are landing in southern Israel. For the last day or so in southern Israel, sirens, you know, like an air raid warning has been going off constantly, hourly, in some of the southern cities. The largest city in the south, Beersheba, a rocket landed on the outskirts just yesterday. So work is canceled. Summer camp is canceled. So the Israelis respond pretty vigorously when that happens.
On the other side, in Gaza, a lot of people have been killed. Do you know how many?
At last count we got from the health ministry here, we're up to 16 today. So there were 16 people in Gaza killed today in Israeli rocket strikes, rocket and missile strikes. Several of those were children.
And I take it there were targeted killings of Hamas officials as well.
Yes, there was. We went to one scene today where a car was passing through a busy intersection in downtown Gaza City by the market, and probably a missile fired by an Israeli drone or maybe another aircraft, but probably a drone hit the car, and the car incinerated, and and there were body parts everywhere, and all four people inside were dead, including the one Hamas operative that they were after, the named operative that they were after,
a
24-year-old guy.
What about ground troops and the possibility of an actual incursion?
Well, the Israeli military has deployed two full infantry brigades along the Gaza border. They've also activated about 1,500 reservists and say they're going to activate more. I think there was some comment from Tel Aviv on that just within the hour. They went into Gaza in 2009 deeply during one of these and cut the Gaza Strip in half with infantry troops. In 2012, they did a more limited incursion. They went over the fence and did some military operations there, but they didn't really roll into the cities.
All this, as Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, has published a editorial by President Barack Obama calling for a peaceful two-state solution. What do you make of the timing?
Well, they've been calling for a peaceful two-state solution for a while, so I hope it comes as soon as possible. It doesn't seem like the atmosphere is good for the Palestinians and the Israelis to sit down together right now, but particularly when rockets are being fired. But there is a split between the Hamas, Islamist militant organization, and the more moderate Palestinian Liberation Organization in Ramallah. So maybe they'll heed President Obama's call, but I don't think in the next few days.
Has there been any reaction from the Palestinians in Ramallah who have joined with Hamas very lately?
Yeah, there is support. There's always support for rocket fire from Hamas and some of the other militant factions when the Israelis and the Palestinians start duking it out in Gaza. It's like a natural response. Maybe with each passing year, maybe the applause is less for it or more muted. But Palestinians in Ramallah and in the Gaza Strip see the rocket fire, many of them do anyway, see the rocket fire as a legitimate response.
Okay.
To what they would call Israeli aggression.
All right. William Booth, again, Jerusalem bureau chief for The Washington Post, speaking to us from Gaza City. Always good to talk with you, and thanks a lot for being with us.
Anytime, Warren. Take care.
In a moment, is Eastern Ukraine in for a bloodbath? On To the Point.
Ever wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. After retaking Slovyansk in the eastern part of his country this weekend, Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko said pro-Russian rebels were making their last stand. But the rebels are showing no signs of making it easy. They're concentrating their forces in Donetsk, and they've blown up three bridges leading into that city of 1 million people. Noah Snyder is a freelance journalist who joins us from Donetsk. And Noah, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Warren. Thanks for having me.
Before we get an update on Donetsk, tell us a bit about what you saw in the other city, Slovyansk, in terms of the kind of damage that's been done there by the fighting.
Absolutely. You know, I think what we see in Slovyansk is the cost of military victory for the Ukrainian army, namely that it's not a resolution to the problem in Donbass, the region, Donetsk and Lugansk regions. In terms both of destruction of infrastructure, the city had been without electricity, without water for several weeks, and for some residents for over a month. Many of them gathered on the square to receive supplies brought in from Ukrainian troops arriving on trucks bearing crates of water. Women, older women, were crying at the mention of electricity being turned back on. And the population really had been, I think, shocked to the point where they weren't even ready to talk about blame. They just needed to eat. And that means that there's going to be a long period of healing that needs to take place in order to bring any region that's faced this kind of conflict back into the fold. And anyone who's thinking about going into Donetsk, as the Ukrainians are, I'm sure, are taking the temperature of the locals in Slavyansk to see what they may be facing in a city of 1 million.
What about that city and the bombing of the bridges leading into it? I take it there was a train on one of them that is sort of suspended there on the broken bridge.
It's sort of hanging above the broken bridge at the entrance towards Donetsk, coming in from Slavyansk to the north. It stopped only, I think, military traffic or transport on the trains. You know, smaller cars are passing through, but it's really added to the atmosphere of fear and the sense of tension that's building in Donetsk. Residents really are off the streets. You don't see many people driving even during the day. And nobody really knows what to expect. Both the rebels and the Ukrainians, Ukrainian government forces, are demonstrating a lot of bravado, sort of trash talking each other. The Ukrainian anti-terrorist operation earlier today, some officials said that the rebels were in for a nasty surprise in Donetsk and Lugansk. And the rebels, meanwhile, claim that they're consolidating their forces. They call the retreat from Slavyansk a tactical decision. And seem to be preparing for a longer partisan war in urban conditions.
You said that in Slavyansk, people were so shocked it was too early, really, to even talk about blame. In Donetsk and generally in eastern Ukraine, do people seem to be siding with the pro-Russian rebels, or are they more in favor of the Ukrainian government, or are they just divided?
You know, I think there's an interesting thing happening. They are becoming fed up with both. On the one hand, folks don't like being bombed, don't like being attacked or being called terrorist or separatist for obvious reasons. And I mean regular citizens who aren't part of the rebel movement. So there's a lot of resentment building up towards the Ukrainian army. I think in Slavyansk that was especially notable. Many of the people who I spoke to there essentially said this is something we will never forget, and it will be very difficult or impossible for us to forgive this. Does it mean that they see the rebels as any better? I'm not certain. And the rebels have been plagued themselves by infighting and also by a seemingly widespread culture of banditism, and there's been a number of reports just in the first few days here in Donetsk, the first few days of the Slavyansk crew's arrival to Donetsk, of kidnappings, of thievery, and it's also obviously not a way to build support amongst the local population.
No.
So I think those who haven't left are feeling trapped with no good options.
Noah Snyder, once again, a freelance writer, journalist in Donetsk. We'll come back to him as our program goes on. Meantime, Mark Galeotti is with us. He's a security expert at New York University's Center for Global Affairs, currently in Moscow. And Mark Galeotti, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Tell us, if you will, what do you think is happening in Russia, and why hasn't Vladimir Putin responded to the demand by the pro-Russian rebels headquartered in Donetsk for assistance? He was the one who urged them to go there in the first place.
To be honest, he's a victim of his own tactics. He stirred up trouble in eastern Ukraine, as near as we can tell, because he thought the result would be that Kiev would quickly capitulate or at least come to terms. Kiev didn't, Kiev couldn't, And now he finds a civil war on his doorstep, and a civil war that actually Ukrainian forces are now in the position that they might conceivably, if bloodily, be able to actually win on the battlefield, which puts him in a very, very unenviable position, even though it is one of his own making. Either he backs away, allows Kiev's forces to basically crush the rebels, and takes what could potentially be a massive political hit for having failed. And Putin is a man who really doesn't like to fail. Or he has to escalate. And it'll mean more than just simply slipping a few more volunteers and the odd tank across the border. I mean, actually, it would probably mean something rather more dramatic, where it's impossible to conceal Russia's fingerprints. And that obviously would come with massive political and economic costs, because the West would have to step up its sanctions. So, I mean, Putin's in a position where he has no good answers. It's really a question of which he thinks is the least worst option.
Does he have troops on the border still?
He does. I mean, he has about 10,000 right by on the border and about another 30,000 nearby. But perhaps more to the point, Russia has such an overwhelming air superiority. I mean, that would be the first way in which Russia could actually try and tilt the balance. It could declare a no-fly zone. It could deny Kiev the use of its own air power. Because if we see how they took Slavyansk, it wasn't by gritty street fighting. It was basically by sitting back and shelling and bombing the town to the point where the rebels felt they had to withdraw. Now, what the Russians could do is use their air power and their long-range artillery to basically say, in the name of, as they would put it, a humanitarian intervention to protect all these civilians, but they would basically say to Kiev that your planes stay grounded, your artillery stop firing, or we will do it for them.
Tell us a little bit more, if you will, about what the forces are on both sides of this a conflict. Who are the pro-Russian separatists, and what about the Ukrainians themselves?
Sure. The separatists are a bizarre and often quite toxic mix of defectors from the Ukrainian security forces, local opportunists, even organized crime figures, genuine, shall I say, patriotic East Ukrainians who think that they've been given a bad deal by Kiev, all kinds of adventurers from Russia, from nationalists to mercenaries. And leavening all of these and providing a stiffening, it does appear clear that there are also actual Russian special forces, just simply providing assistance and coordination. The thing is that as they get pushed back to Donetsk, because it looks likely that the other key city, Luhansk, is unlikely to be able to be held, they probably will acquire more and more cohesion because they realize that they have to work together. And this means that a Russian who goes by the name of Strelkov, who is the defense minister of the Donetsk People's Republic, will probably emerge as the unquestioned sort of generalissimo. So ironically, as they lose, the rebels will acquire more cohesion. On the other side, the Ukrainian forces, again, it's an interesting mix. There are regular Ukrainian troops who are beginning to gain the kind of morale and will to fight that they lacked at first. But then there's also really what are a lot of local militias on their side as well. They've been sworn into the so-called National Guard. They've been given a couple of weeks training, but basically they're volunteers, some of whom come from ultra-nationalist groups, others don't. And their discipline, frankly, seems much, much more questionable. So really, this is going the way of so many civil wars, which is actually that you end up with two sides, both of whom have all kinds of different, rival almost groups within them, and therefore command, control, discipline all become problematic. But when it comes down to it, ultimately, the Ukrainian troops have a lot more firepower at their disposal if they can use it.
Mark Galeotti, once again at New York University Center for Global Affairs, currently speaking to us from Moscow. Back to Noah Snyder, who is in Donetsk, our freelance writer and journalist. Mark Galeotti used the term civil war a couple of times. Is that what you think is going on?
I would agree. I would agree 100%. I think it's disingenuous at this point to really call it anything else. You have a rebel force, as Mark said, that's made up of a kind of a noxious mix of different characters, but contains a majority, I would say, of Ukrainians, of Ukrainian locals or Ukrainians from other parts of the country, perhaps Odessa or Crimea. and they are engaged in a constant battle against their own government. I don't think it's possible to call it anything but a civil war.
Let me introduce Stephen Pfeiffer. He is a former ambassador to Ukraine. He's now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And Mr. Pfeiffer, good to have you back on our program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
How do you see the situation, first of all, from the Ukrainian point of view and the new president, Petro Poroshenko?
Well, I think Mr. Poroshenko he has to be happy with the military performance that he's seen over the last week or so. You know, this has been much better than the Ukrainian military and security forces have done over most of the last 2.5 months of fighting in the East. But I think it's also very important that he not overplay his hand, you know, particularly when you're looking at what is the next step with regards to the concentration of the separatist forces in Donetsk, where it could be very bloody if care is not taken. And I think it's also important that in addition to continuing military operations, which he appears to be intent on doing, he's got to do a couple things on the political side. One, it's important to move into cities like Slovyansk and Kramatorsk, which were taken back by government forces over the weekend, and move very quickly to restore civils, restore municipal services, restore normalcy, begin to get those cities back functioning again. I think that's going to be important to his political perspective. And also, I think it's important that he begin to sketch out in a bit more detail ideas that he's proposed with regards to decentralization of power, pushing some authority out to the regions, including in Donetsk and Luhansk, some specifics on the status of Russian language, moving forward with the idea of early Rada elections, because that can create a political context, which I think can strengthen his appeal with a large portion of the population in Donetsk and Luhansk, which is still trying to figure out where to go. And again, to the extent that he couples the military operation with political messages that say, look, he plans to be the president of all Ukraine. He plans to take into account the concerns of eastern Ukraine, take their interests on board. That's going to strengthen his hand politically.
Mark Galeotti, you described at length the nature of the people who are referred to generally as the pro-Russian rebels. Would decentralization, do you think, of the sort just described by Ambassador Pfeiffer, help in terms of getting more support for the Ukrainian government and less for them?
Yes, and I think the key point about decentralization, and here I think Stephen was absolutely right about Poroshenko needing to not overplay his hand and reach out in some ways, is also that would actually speak to Moscow's concerns. To an extent, this is a civil war that is being fought for entirely domestic reasons, and you've got local elites that clearly are worried about their future. But what really has given this such an edge is precisely the extent to which the Russians are supporting them. If Moscow can at least be given some kind of pretext for claiming that they have been successful, it's clear that Putin would like to back away from the insurgents at the moment. If decentralization comes onto the political table, then potentially it gives him that chance to say, well, fair enough, we've only been pushing because we knew that there needed to be something done to address the legitimate political concerns of the East. Now that that's being acknowledged by Kiev, we can let them sort it out, and that way he can extricate himself. So, I mean, I definitely think that, in fact, decentralization has to be part of any kind of resolution.
Ambassador Pfeiffer, do you agree with Mark Galeotti's earlier comment that Mr. Putin is a victim of his own tactics?
No, I think Mr. Putin is in somewhat of a dilemma. He has three options. One is to continue the current course, which is providing supplies, weapons to the separatists. He can veer in one direction, which would be basically to cut that support and really back a peaceful settlement. And there may be pieces out there, the things like decentralization, status for Russian language, that would give him a basis for declaring victory. The other end of the spectrum, though, is that he decides to go all in and sends the Russian military in, which I think at the end of the day, the Russians really do not want to do.
Okay. Hold that thought. We need to take a break. We'll come back and continue this conversation about what's going on in Ukraine on our talking point later. The U.S. is importing its own fish. We'll hear about an unhealthy paradox of the global economy on To the Point from PRI.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
Warman Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the success of the Ukrainian army in getting pro-Russian separatists out of Slovyansk. They have now moved into Donetsk. It bombed three bridges that would provide entrance into that city and seem to be holding up there. They have asked for support from Russia's President Putin, who encouraged them to be there in the first place. We've just heard from former ambassador to Ukraine, Stephen Pfeiffer, that Mr. Putin has three options. One is to cut support for the separatists altogether and make peace. The other is to continue aid to them with supplies and arms. The other is to send in the Russian army. Mr. Ambassador, which do you think Mr. Putin has chosen to do?
Well, I'm hoping very much that he opts for the first option. That is to try to use his influence. And the Russian government has a lot of influence with the separatists to urge them towards a settlement of the conflict. And that involves also the cutting off the flow of arms that's crossing from the Russian border into Ukraine. But I fear he may be tempted to try the second option, continue to support the separatists and see if they can't change the dynamic on the battlefield.
You don't think there's a chance that he'll use the Russian army?
I think that there is a chance, but it's something that the Russian army probably does not want to do. And I don't think Mr. Putin wants to do it for a couple of reasons. One, I think as Mark mentioned, there's no doubt that the Russian military could probably have a not very difficult time dealing with the Ukrainian military. But if they did occupy Donetsk and Luhansk, they would likely find themselves engaged in a partisan war. Moreover, that kind of overuse of the Russian military in Ukraine would persuade even the most reluctant members of the European Union to move towards very severe economic sanctions on Russia, which could have a huge impact on an economy that's already on the verge of a recession in Russia.
Listening to this conversation has been Dmitry Trenin. He is director of the Carnegie Moscow Center. He joins us from Moscow. Dmitry Trenin, good to have you back on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We heard earlier from Mark Galeotti that Mr. Putin will take a political hit at home if he is perceived to have failed with regard to Ukraine. What do you think he is doing? Is he more likely now to try to make peace or encourage the pro-Russian rebels to make peace? Or is he more likely to continue things pretty much as they are?
Well, I think that Mr. Putin's tactics and strategy may change, but his and Russia's goals remain pretty much permanent. And those goals include keeping Ukraine away from NATO. It's continuing to maintain economic ties to eastern Ukraine and securing a status for the Russian language so that the cultural identity of Russian speakers in Ukraine is not taken away from them. Now, I think that Putin has changed several tactics since the beginning of the Ukrainian crisis. The crisis will continue. We're dealing with a long-term instability. Mr. Putin, I think, will be changing his tactics in the future. At this point, I think he is focused on having some kind of a dialogue between the Ukrainian government and the loosely defined representatives of eastern Ukraine. And this is something that Kiev at this point rejects because that would be from Kiev's in Kiev's parlance talking to terrorists. So that's where we are at this point.
Let me go back to Noah Snyder, our journalist, who is in Donetsk and has been in Kiev as well. What about the government and their insistence on calling the pro-Russian rebels, as we call them, terrorists? Do those people have legitimate grievances that ought to be addressed, do you think, by the Ukrainian government?
Well, absolutely. I think they have legitimate grievances, or at least the starting points for legitimate grievances. The problem is that a lot of those legitimate problems have been blown out of proportion and twisted and warped in the Russian propaganda machine. So what began as perhaps legitimate concerns about the status of Russian language, it's worth noting, remembering that the new Ukrainian government, one of the first moves was the passage of a bill that would have stripped Russian its official language status in the East, which it was ultimately vetoed, but was a flashpoint for many. That has turned into talk of a junta and even of genocide against the Russian-speaking population, which is clearly not going on. So I think there's a balance and in terms of finding political solutions and antagonizing the population by calling them terrorists is tipping folks further towards believing the narrative about genocide, about a junta, about the return of neo-Nazis and fascists, when in fact the legitimate grievances that do exist are ultimately political grievances, economic grievances, problems that can be solved around the negotiating table rather than with violence.
So, Dmitry Trenin, back to you at the Carnegie Moscow Center. Would the president of Ukraine, newly elected, Mr. Petroshenko, be making a mistake not to negotiate, and will he perpetuate the crisis if he doesn't?
I think that Mr. Poroshenko finds himself at a very potentially very dangerous point. Should the Ukrainian forces start a serious bombardment of Donetsk and Lugansk, the price of victory would be horrendous. There may be no end to the instability in eastern Ukraine. The situation may really turn against Kiev at this point. So I think that in Kiev's best interests and in Ukraine's best interests today would be to find a formula for some kind of a dialogue with a representative group from the eastern regions. Otherwise, not only the price of victory in Ukraine will be too high, but there's a certain limit beyond which Mr. Putin will not be able to continue to exercise his restraint, if you like, with respect to the use of the Russian forces. If we're talking about thousands of casualties among civilians, he will be under very serious pressure within the country to do something about it. And this could be a very dangerous turning point in the international aspect of the Ukraine crisis.
Former Ambassador Pfeiffer, back to you. What should the U.S. do in this situation? Should it be helping the Ukrainian military, or should it provide some other kind of assistance?
Well, I think there are a couple of things here. I have in the past supported support to the Ukrainian military, which has gone through a very difficult 20 years and is vastly out-equipped, for example, with having to face the Russian military. But in some cases, its equipment doesn't compare well with what some of the separatists have had. But I think the other thing that the United States can be doing is there is a role here to caution Mr. Poroshenko and not overplay the hand. And I was very interested in the sorts of things that Dmitry suggested with regards to issues, Ukraine not going into NATO, maintaining economic ties between eastern Ukraine and Russia, status for the Russian language, and if you added that into decentralization, there should be a package there that would allow, I think, Mr. Poroshenko, the Russians, and many in eastern Ukraine to say this can resolve the deal peacefully. The challenge, though, I think, as has already been mentioned a couple times, is it's not clear who can speak for eastern Ukraine. I think the government in Kyiv has been very specific that it's not prepared to deal with the guys with guns, but you haven't yet had somebody else emerge in whom the population as well as the separatists have confidence as a spokesperson. And that makes the dialogue very difficult to manage when there's not somebody sitting on the other side of the table.
So, Mark Galeotti, back to you at the New York University Center for Global Affairs, currently in Moscow. As you indicated earlier, it's not just a question of President Poroshenko and President Putin. There are a lot of other players involved. Is it in their interests? You mentioned various militias, for example. Is it in their interest to have a dialogue about this, or do they want to see the current instability continue?
They've benefited from the current instability, but I think it's clear to them that if, for example, Russia turned its back on them, then their long-term survival would be very, very limited. But of course, ultimately, you need to build a situation, a political framework, which will allow as many as possible of these people to be brought back into the system. There are going to be some diehards, some thugs, murderers, sociopaths, and gangsters who will not, cannot actually reach a deal with Kiev. The thing to do is to minimize them and reach some kind of a dialogue. And that will mean that Kiev is going to have to accept that it's not going to get everything it wants. It means that it's going to have to accept that it's going to deal with some people whom it might well find distinctly unsavory. And here, I mean, you know, Noah's point about the unhelpfulness of using the word terrorist is absolutely on point, because the thing is that whenever you find this kind of serious internal problem dealt with through a political process, and it doesn't matter if we're looking at Britain in Northern Ireland or whatever, when it comes down to it, you have to accept that you're going to have to talk to people with whom you've been fighting, unless you just want to keep fighting them. So some people will be not willing or not able to join any kind of peace process, but the key thing is to build one that will encourage as many people as possible to feel that better this than to actually go down fighting.
Stephen Pfeiffer, it was said earlier by Dmitry Trenin that one of Mr. Putin's objectives is to keep Ukraine as far from NATO as possible. Is there any chance that NATO is interested in having Ukraine as a member at this point, or is NATO in any way able to affect the current situation?
Well, I think there's two points to be made here. Both President Poroshenko and actually today the deputy head of the presidential administration said that NATO is off the table for Ukraine. And I think that's because they realize that that would be a hugely controversial foreign policy issue within Ukraine. It would further inflame tensions with eastern Ukraine at a time when they need to reach out and find ways to mend those divisions. So I think NATO is a very delicate issue. It's a very touchy issue, and the government in Kyiv is wise to push that off the table for now. But the other point is, I don't think that there's much appetite among NATO countries to enlarge to bring Ukraine in. I think NATO countries want to have a good cooperative relationship with Ukraine. But the idea of bringing Ukraine into the alliance, when it brings with it potentially the requirement to extend the Article 5, an attack against one is an attack against all, a security guarantee, potentially means a conflict with Russia. So I don't think that there's much appetite in NATO Europe for that kind of step. So my guess is there ought to be a way. I think it would be hard for either NATO or Ukraine to say, no, how, never, never, never would Ukraine ever enter NATO. But I think there ought to be a way to finesse this issue and make very clear in a way that could be reassuring to the Russians that NATO is not an issue for Ukraine for the foreseeable future.
So, Dmitry Trenin, if NATO is off the table as far as Ukraine is concerned, does that make it easier for President Putin to become a peacemaker?
Well, I think that President Putin supported the federalization of Ukraine in particular because he wanted to erect domestic Ukrainian internal blocks to any move toward NATO. He would not take Kiev's assurances or Western assurances about NATO being off the table at face value. So I think that this is a serious issue for Putin and the Russian leadership. But I think that the Russian leadership at this point is genuinely interested in some kind of a settlement in Ukraine that would take care of their core interests or their vital interests. But absent such a settlement, the Ukrainian situation will not quieten down, and Ukraine will not become a stable state anytime soon, in my judgment. Ukraine stands before pretty serious economic difficulties within the next few months or a couple of years. So Russia, if there's a failure to reach some kind of an accommodation with between Russia and Ukraine, with Europe and the United States taking part in that, we can see continued instability and continued actions by Russia and by the West that would make sure that Ukraine will continue to be an international crisis spot.
Stephen Pfeiffer, you were ambassador to Ukraine. Would this instability in that country have occurred regardless of whether President Putin originally encouraged the pro-Russian demonstrators to do what they're doing, or has it really been caused by his actions in annexing Crimea?
Well, I think after Crimea, there was perhaps an expectation in Moscow that you would see larger protests in eastern Ukraine advocating either separatism or joining with Russia. And in my view, when that didn't happen, that's when you saw the appearance of the so-called little green men. This is a term Ukrainians use for the soldiers in Russian combat uniforms with no insignia who turned up in Crimea. And for a while, Mr. Putin said they were not Russian troops. And in May, then he admitted that they were. We saw some of those begin to appear, I think, in eastern Ukraine, although certainly a large number of the separatists are local Ukrainians. So I think you have that layer of the problem. But it's laid on a Ukraine which is in a fairly fragile and vulnerable position, primarily because of bad decisions made by 20 years of Ukrainian leaders. There's lots of things that Ukraine could have done to strengthen their democratic and their governmental institutions. They could have done things to build the economy in ways that perhaps would have overcome the sorts of tensions you're seeing now. And the hope is if Mr. Poroshenko can find a way to settle this conflict in the east, can he then get back to, you know, the very important job also of putting in the economic reforms, the political reforms that get Ukraine moving in the right direction as opposed to marching in circles as it has in the last 20 years.
Noah Snyder, very quickly, back to the current situation in Donetsk. You know a good deal about the people who are referred to as the pro-Russian rebels, whether they are terrorists, as called by the government of Ukraine, or whether they're thugs, murderers, sociopaths, and gangsters, which was Mark Galliotti's way of describing at least some of them. What's the president of Ukraine going to do about them in the event that this situation can be turned into something other than a military assault?
Well, I think that's one of the big problems, and it's one of the problems that the Ukrainians don't have a good answer for. I was in Slavyansk just yesterday, and we ran into the interior minister, Arseniy Avakov, on the central square, and the radical political candidate, Oleg Lyashko, who received over 8% in the recent presidential vote. And both of them had rather extreme and differing views on what to do with folks who were involved in the separatist movement. Lyashko advocating, obviously, for a more extreme version that he called de-separatification and compared to denazification in post-war Germany. Mr. Avakov, for his part, had little in the way of a concrete answer. They claimed that they would carry out investigations, but I think most of these men will melt back easily into the civilian population, which they're originally a part of. And even in Slavyansk, we were hearing reports that some of the fighters hadn't actually left, that they'd simply changed from their camouflage into their civilian clothes and were taking pot shots at the Ukrainian forces during the night. So I think it'll be a continuing problem. And for a lot of those guys, especially the more sociopathic element, this is the first thing in their lives that's given them a sense of purpose and a sense of meaning. And it'll be really difficult to go back to normal life.
Well, thank you all very much for giving us a better sense of what's going on in Ukraine, how likely it is to continue, and what the various options might be. Noah Snyder, again, a freelance journalist currently in Donetsk. Mark Galliotti at New York University Center for Global Affairs. He's currently in Moscow. Stephen Pfeiffer, former ambassador to Ukraine, now at the Brookings Institution. Dmitry Trenin joining us as director of the Carnegie Moscow Center. Great to have you all. Thank you very much for being on our program today. 91% of the seafood Americans consume is imported, while a third of what's caught in American waters is shipped to other countries. Somehow that doesn't seem to make sense, and we'll hear how and why it's happening, which it is, in a moment on To the Point.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
We're only back with today's talking point. American Catch is a new book subtitled The Fight for Our Local Seafood. It's a book by Paul Greenberg, author of a very popular book, For Fish, contributor to the New York Times fellow at the Blue Ocean Institute. American Catch, the new book, reports, among other things, that the U.S. imports its own fish. Paul Greenberg, welcome to our program.
Thanks, Warren.
How did this happen?
Well, I mean, let's take a salmon, for example. A lot of our Alaska salmon, about 80% of it actually that we catch it, we freeze it, we send it to China. It's defrosted, filleted and boned, and then refrozen and sent back to us twice frozen. So those are some food miles.
Is that because we don't want to take the bones out ourselves?
Yeah, that's a big part of it. The labor in China is just so much cheaper. But there's also this sort of backdoor to Asia that has been opened up between our countries that Asians, generally speaking, I was talking to a coastal fisherman in California who said to me, Americans, they just aren't hip to fish, and Asians are. And so all of our really great wild seafood is really appreciated in Asia, and so we're sending it over here. Sending it over to Asia. And what we like over here are cheap fish. So things like tilapia, this weird fish called the Pangasius catfish that actually breathes air and is our sixth most popular seafood here, that gets sent from Vietnam over to here. So we're importing a lot of cheap farm stuff, exporting a lot of expensive wild stuff.
What's happened over the years to American fisheries?
Well, certain fisheries have really gotten beaten up. The first example I use in the book is the example of the eastern oyster. We used to produce something like 2 billion pounds of oysters per year, and Americans ate them. We ate as much oysters per capita as we now eat shrimp. Oysters went into a severe decline when we let them sort of get polluted and fall apart. We're now rebuilding them, but they're still in very, very serious decline. Now, that's oysters, and that's a very specific thing. The other thing that happened is we had a huge post-war buildup of American fishing effort right after World War II because we were trying to grab more ocean. Right after World War II, nations started claiming more and more territorial ocean. Well, we didn't want to send the Navy out there to grab that ocean. So instead, what we did is we sent a bunch of fishermen. We paid them more money to build their boats, to build up the fleet. Well, surprise, you build up your fleet like that, you're going to get a lot of overfishing. And that's why we had a huge overfishing crisis in this country in the 70s and 80s and early 90s. Now, fisheries in America are actually on the mend. We've had this 20-year rebuilding period where American fisheries have gotten quite healthy relative to many other countries in the world. Unfortunately, now Americans have lost the taste for their own fish, and we're sending so much of it abroad now.
What about shrimp?
Shrimp is one of the most problematic seafoods on the market today. That represents, the vast majority of the seafood Americans consume. We consume more 4 pounds of shrimp per year, more shrimp than the next two combined, salmon and tuna. 90% of it is coming to us from Asia. A portion of it seems to be coming to us as the result of slave labor that is employed to catch the trash fish that are then ground up and fed to the shrimp farms in Thailand, which is our major provider of shrimp. And then shrimp also can cause farm shrimp can cause the destruction of coastal mangrove forests in Southeast Asia and in Latin America. And if you follow your coastal issues, mangrove forests are critical for flood protection, exactly the kind of thing that we're going to need in the coming years as seas rise and global warming changes our coastal environment.
What are the health implications of the fish diet that we now consume as Americans? We talk about wild-caught salmon. That's very expensive in fish stores for those who want to buy it. But on the other hand, as you mentioned, a lot of the fish that comes from Asia is farmed. Does that make a difference in terms of its nutritional value?
Well, with fish farming and seafood farming, it is what it eats. So if you feed a salmon a lot of things like anchovies and sardines, which are high in omega-3s, the salmon will be very high in omega-3s. But the vast majority of the things that we do import, shrimp, tilapia, Pangasius catfish, these farmed things, are all relatively low in omega-3s. And that's the health tragedy there, is that we're bringing in all this stuff that has relatively low omega-3s, and we're sending things like, you know, black cod. I don't know if you ever had black cod, but it's a great, great fish, sustainably caught, abundant, but almost all of it goes abroad, a lot of it to Japan. So, you know, it's a conundrum. And then if you look at the overall seafood versus land food picture, you know, we eat only about 15 pounds of seafood per person per year. Contrast that with 200 pounds of chicken, pork, and beef industrially raised that the average American consumes per year.
So a lot of it has to do with the choice of consumers. Very quickly, because we've got you and you are an expert on fish, why is July the best time to buy salmon that has not been frozen?
It's the only time. Salmon come in to Alaska in huge, huge numbers, and the canneries and the processing plants can't deal with them all, so they have to can it or freeze it or let it rot. This is the only time that a lot of that fish is coming to us fresh. So if you see a sockeye salmon on ice at your local Whole Foods or your fish market, snap it up, buy it now, because it ain't going to be fresh in a month.
What about finding out what your salmon has eaten?
You mean if it's farmed?
Yeah.
Well, if it's farmed, chances are your salmon is going to be fed on a diet that consists a lot of anchovies and sardines and, you know, more and more soy products. Some farmers actually use chicken byproducts. And it's interesting because fish sometimes are fed to chicken. And I always wonder, is there a fish out there that ate a chicken that ate a fish? But the you know, wheels within wheels. But generally, you can't really know what your fish ate. I think you have to go. There is something called the Aquaculture Stewardship Council that's a newly minted standard organization. You'll see the ASC logo on farmed salmon product, and it's a good standard, if you can find it, to show that your salmon was decently raised.
Are you optimistic about whether we can, in fact, get more local seafood if we want it?
It's there if we want it. You know, the fact that we're sending so much abroad and importing so much means that really we just need to turn the spigots in the other direction. But what that will involve is building local seafood infrastructure. There's a crop of new things appearing all up and down our coast called community-supported fisheries, where it's like a CSA, like with agriculture, but you buy a share at the beginning of the year and you get salmon throughout the year or fish from your local waters throughout the year.
Okay, Paul Greenberg, latest book, American Catch, The Fight of for Our Local Seafood. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Warren.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.